It's VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Alice Bryant will present this week's lesson in everyday grammar. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Rhino Bulls usually makes a living from his tourism business in South Africa's wine country. But the coronavirus health crisis has forced him to find another way to earn money. So he sold one of his tourism vehicles and bought a group of pregnant cows. He will have to wait for the cows to give birth and for the calves to be old enough to sell before he can make money from them. That probably will not happen until early next year. Bulls hopes to see a return of some tourists in November, the start of South Africa's tourism season. He makes 80% of his money from foreign visitors. If those visitors do not come, he will need the profit from his cattle to keep his business in operation. The World Travel and Tourism Council estimates that the lack of tourism will cause Africa to lose between $53 billion and $120 billion in 2020. Kenya expects at least a 60% drop in money from tourism this year. South Africa expects a 75% drop. In South Africa, the Tourism Business Council estimates 1.2 million tourism-related jobs are already affected. That is about 10% of total jobs in Africa's most developed economy. South Africa's borders have been closed for nearly 6 months, and there are no signs of them reopening. COVID-19 restrictions have put a stop to the biggest part of African tourism, the safari. Safaris are trips to see or hunt animals. James Wilson is the marketing director for Desert and Delta. For nearly 40 years, Desert and Delta has sold safaris in the Okavango Delta in northern Botswana. Wilson says that the company's clients have always been from North America or Western Europe. They are usually wealthy, retired, and almost always over 60 years old. He worries that those retirees will be the last to come back because of their age and risk of infection from COVID-19. Gillian Blackbeard is the chief executive officer of a tourism association that represents safari operators in Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. She said, "It will take Southern Africa's safari tourism 3 years to recover." But Blackbeard says the COVID-19 health crisis may provide a chance for the African tourism industry to reach different kinds of people. She hopes to attract their own African tourists, as well as people from Asia and North American minority groups. Graham Wood is Chief Operating Officer for Hospitality for Sun International. The company owns many casinos, vacation areas, and costly hotels in South Africa and several other African countries. So far, Sun International has kept its 8,500 employees, but on reduced wages. Wood said the company is now having to consider quite severe restructures. Wood does expect an increase in domestic tourism at the end of the year from South Africans who are not traveling internationally. Domestic tourism did increase last month when South Africa eased restrictions to permit travel within the country for the first time since late March. But the international tourist season this year is not going to materialize, Wood said. That will be ruinous for Rhino Bowls. His attempts to appeal to locals have not had much success. His adventure tourism company combines hiking and cycling with wine tasting tours in the mountains of Stellenbosch, near Cape Town. He hopes that his foreign clients are willing enough to come back sometime during the season. He will only really know early next year. And Bowles will only know then if he can re-employ all his tour guides. They are experts in wine and the natural environment of the Stellenbosch Mountains. Bowles said, "We can only do proper business once international borders open again."
Every language has its own way of saying something happened in the past, is happening now, or will happen in the future. As you know, English does this through verb tenses. Most English tenses use a word form called a participle. There are present participles and past participles. Take the statement, "I have been to Atlanta." It uses been, which is the past participle of the verb be. In addition to forming verb tenses, the past participle can form two other things. One is the passive voice, and the other is adjectives. On today's program, I will talk about all three of these. By now in your English studies, you have heard and seen the past participle countless times. You just may not have known what it was called. In fact, I used it a few times in this paragraph alone. The past participle is everywhere, so let me begin with a quick discussion about recognizing it. You probably know that the past tense of a regular verb ends in ed, as in, "I talked to my friend." For regular verbs, the past participle also ends in ed. In other words, it is identical, as in, "I have talked to her about my plans." Most English verbs are regular, so most of their past participles are identical to the past tense. But for irregular verbs, the past participles and past tenses are not the same. Think of the verb take as an example. Its past tense is took, as in, "I took my mother to the park." The past participle is taken, as in, "She has taken that flight many times." Okay, now let's get into today's subject, the three uses for past participles. The first we will look at is perfect verb tenses. As a reminder, a perfect tense is one that puts some form of the verb have before its main verb. Take one of my examples again. "She has taken that flight many times. I used the present perfect tense, which is have or has plus past participle. Knowing the name of this or other verb tenses is not important for today's lesson. The thing to remember is this. All perfect tenses in English include the past participle. Listen for it in this next example.
She had studied English before moving to the U.S.
The speaker used the past participle studied as part of the past perfect verb had studied. Again, do not worry if you do not know the names of these verb tenses. Simply note that they are perfect tenses, and perfect tenses use past participles. Next, let's talk about the passive voice, the second use for the past participle. Here is a quick refresher. In most sentences in English, the subject performs the action of the verb. Take the example, you called a friend. The subject is you, and the subject performs the action called. But sometimes the subject is acted upon or receives the action of the verb. This is called the passive voice. Imagine that someone steals your bike. You could say, "My bike was stolen." There is no mention of the person because you do not know who did it. We can use passive voice when we do not know who or what performed the action, or when identifying the performer is not important. In English, the most basic passive voice is formed with be plus past participle. Let's examine the bike example. My bike was stolen. Here, the verb be appears in the past tense was, and stolen is the past participle of steal. Listen for be plus past participle in this next example.
The dish is cooked over an open fire.
Here, the verb be is in the present tense, is. Cook is a regular verb, so its past participle is cooked. And finally, we turn to adjectives, the third use for past participles. Only some past participles can be used as adjectives. These adjectives are a little different from normal ones because they generally describe how someone feels. The adjective bored is a good example. If you wanted to describe this feeling in a group of children, you could say this.
The children are bored.
Notice that the adjective comes after the linking verb be. You can learn more about linking verbs on earlier programs. Now, suppose these same children begin to misbehave. You could say this.
The bored children are getting into trouble.
Here, the speaker put the adjective bored before the noun children. When past participles act as adjectives, they appear in the same places as normal adjectives, after linking verbs and before nouns. But note again that these kinds of adjectives describe a person or people's feelings. And that's Everyday Grammar for this week. I'm Alice Bryant.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, Wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1801, America had a new president, Thomas Jefferson from the state of Virginia. Jefferson had already done much for his country. He wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He served as America's first ambassador to France and the first Secretary of State. Now he would govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson was happy and hopeful as he took office. His new political party, the Republicans, had defeated the older Federalist Party. The Federalists had controlled the cabinet and the Congress during President George Washington's two terms. George Washington was not a Federalist, but America's second president, John Adams, was. Altogether, the Federalists had been in power for 12 years. The Federalists and the Republicans held very different opinions about how to govern the nation. The Federalists feared that Jefferson and his followers would destroy the social order of the new country. And Jefferson's Republican Party feared that the Federalists would put power in the hands of a few elite people.
The fears of neither side were really justified, but it was a remarkable moment because the election of 1800 was extremely partisan, but it was also the first occasion in which power was exchanged from one party to another without any kind of violence or a revolution.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs an international center for Jefferson studies at Thomas Jefferson's home called Monticello. He says emotions between the Federalists and the Republicans were still strong when Jefferson took office. But in his inaugural address, the new president extended the hand of peace and friendship to the Federalists. In his words, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." The leader of the Federalist Party, Alexander Hamilton, did not accept Jefferson's offer of friendship. As Jefferson became president, Hamilton made a speech attacking him. Hamilton had decided to continue fighting the Democratic movement in the United States. But Hamilton's opposition did not worry Jefferson. "Of course," he said, "the top leaders of the Federalists, men like Hamilton, could never be changed. He was more interested in bringing their followers to his side. He was sure he could show even the Federalists that his program was good for all." In fact, Andrew O'Shaughnessy says, Jefferson expected the Federalist Party just to disappear. He says, people in Jefferson's time did not think a two-party system was essential to democracy.
They thought if people acted in a public spirit and put aside their own self-interest, that they would all recognize the common good and act together.
And he says Jefferson believed his party, the Republicans, represented the true spirit of the American Revolution. In those early days of 1801, Jefferson said, "We can no longer say that there is nothing new under the sun. What we have done in this country is all new. The force of public opinion is new. But the most important and pleasing newness is that we have changed our government without violence. This shows a strength of American character that will give long life to our republic. We have proved that freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of thought are necessary in a healthy nation. Let men argue with each other. The arguments may become bitter, but the bitterness is just a cloud that passes. And out of the arguments will come the truth. As for the Federalist leaders, they, except for Hamilton, believed Jefferson's friendly words in his inaugural speech showed he would respect their party. George Cabot, the strongest Federalist leader in New England, usually agreed with Hamilton, but now he did not. Cabot said, "I believe that our new president wants to stay out of war. We do not have to worry any longer that he plans to join France against England. He is friendly to us and wants our help. Therefore, I am sure that he will not dismiss any of our people from their government positions." Another Federalist leader, Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State under President Adams, said, "I am satisfied that Jefferson will not make any important changes in government policy and that he will depend for support more on us Federalists than on the Democrats." During those first few weeks of the new government, the Federalist leaders really believed that Jefferson was afraid of them. They believed that he had surrendered to them and would be destroyed as the leader of the Republican Party. One Federalist wrote, "Soon Jefferson will feel the bite of his dirty Democrats when they attack him." Jefferson soon did hear complaints from Republican leaders who felt he was being too kind to the Federalists. William Giles, a Jeffersonian leader in Virginia, wrote, "Of course, I am very pleased by the president's inaugural speech. The president's program is correct. It agrees with the opinions of the people. But I still think that the president's success will depend on how he carries out his program. Let him offer friendship to the Federalists, but he must not permit friendship to become weakness. His friends believe that the first thing he must do is to clean out the executive branch of the government. He must dismiss from office all men who are enemies of the Republican program." Even James Monroe wrote a strong letter to the president, "Your speech and your program are healthy and good, but there are serious dangers ahead of you. There are two parties in this country, not one. One of these parties, the Federalists, has controlled the government for 12 years and has hurt our nation greatly. Some of these Federalists now speak softly to you and promise their support. But you must remember, too, that there are thousands of good Republicans who have always supported you. If you keep Federalists in office, if you appoint Federalists to office, many of these good Republicans will stop believing in you. Certainly, there is no reason why you should give jobs to men who worked for the Federalist government of John Adams. Certainly, you must throw out the officials of the last government who stole money and sold their services. Do this, and you will give strength to our Republican movement. Please understand me. I am speaking only of high offices. I do not ask that you dismiss small officials because they are Federalists. They have a right to their political beliefs. Let them keep their jobs. This will show that you are a president who can accept different political opinions. As Federalists and Republican leaders kept asking Jefferson for positions in the government, the president was thinking of his cabinet. He quickly decided who would be his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. James Madison of Virginia, Jefferson's old friend and the father of the Constitution, would be Secretary of State. For Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson chose Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, the brilliant leader of the Republicans in Congress. Gallatin understood economics and finance as well as Alexander Hamilton did. For the War Department, Jefferson turned to General Henry Dearborn of New England. Jefferson's first choice to be Secretary of the Navy was Judge Robert Livingston, the great lawyer from New York. But Judge Livingston rejected this position. Jefferson finally chose Robert Smith of Baltimore, Maryland. The president had already appointed one man from New England to his cabinet, Secretary of War Dearborn. Now he turned to New England for two more appointments. Jefferson knew that the strength of the Federalist Party was greater in New England than in any other part of the country. He believed that there was no better way to move New England away from the Federalist program than to give cabinet positions to men from New England. And so, Jefferson found his attorney general in Levi Lincoln of Massachusetts. Like Dearborn, Lincoln was a patriot of the American Revolution. He had been a supporter of Jefferson from the beginning. He was famous as a lawyer in Massachusetts, where he was the top leader of the Republican Party. Jefferson turned to New England as well for the Postmaster General. It was not yet a cabinet office, but its importance was growing. The president gave this appointment to Gideon Granger, a lawyer, businessman, and writer. Granger was one of the strong Jeffersonians in the state of Connecticut. Such was Jefferson's cabinet, all strong Republicans, all completely loyal. The Federalists were shocked. Not one member of their party had been appointed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.